Welcome everyone to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today worked at Valve for 8+ years. He's a bit of a veteran in that space, you could say, because most people don't stay at one place for that long, but he did. He also worked in the dental AI space for a bit, and now he's just taking a break, enjoying the break, so to speak, working holiday. I'd like to welcome Chandler Murch.
Thank you, Reese. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. I have to ask, because obviously the name Chandler, and it's associated with friends quite a lot, but do people, you know, be like, oh, that's a cool name. Well, how'd you get that name?
Yeah, you are inadvertently dating yourself, Reese, in terms of your age, because nowadays you say Chandler for friends and you just get blank stares. But I've been asked that a lot. Definitely, I predate the character, but over the years I would always get one of two questions, which was Chandler like from Friends, or I bet a lot of people ask you Chandler like from Friends, but I'm not gonna do that. It's like, well, that's
you kind
basically
of
the same thing. I came first.
it's good to be first. So I wanted to ask, obviously, about Valve and how you ended up there. Did you actually apply for a role there, or did they approach you? Because some of the Valve developers were approached, but yes. What was the situation there?
I had a background in IT, information technology, for several years prior, but I was living in Illinois, about an hour from Chicago. And decided I didn't want to be there anymore, and I wanted to work for a video game company. And there's only a few places in the US that are really, you know, kind of hubs for it, and I decided that I wanted to live in the Seattle area, so moved there and found another IT position. And after about 6 months, I was ready to continue the search for an actual game company. And my girlfriend at the time was working in this physical therapy clinic, and she met someone who was wearing a Valve shirt, and she knew that I had, tried to talk to them. And, I'm sure it's like I set my resume down and it just went into the round file. who's this guy off the street? But when you know someone, of course, things are a little bit different. And I got to know this person well, and he was very happy to kind of pass the recommendation along. But he said, I don't know about our actual IT jobs, but we're always looking to hire people. And I know, especially, Steam customer service, Steam support is, always needs good people. And that'd probably be something we could throw you in your hat in the ring for. And I was like, at that point in my career, thinking, this feels like kind of a step backwards, because customer service, I was like, I'm going to be answering a lot of, customer issues, and not super challenging, but I thought, this is a foot in the door. I didn't really know much about Valve as a company. I was familiar with Steam and familiar with their games, but by taking that chance and doing the interview and being offered a contract position, it was like the best decision that I could have made.
So what did you so what did you do when you first got there? Because how Valve doesn't really have a hierarchical, a hierarchy, so to speak. So
yeah,
in terms of its structure,
right? Well, so Steam support at the time was maybe about 30 to 40 folks, and some had maybe had some other kind of prior game studio experience, maybe as QA or something like that, but in general, kind of a lot of people early in their careers. And it was you know, it was just all of the things that you get as a Steam support agent. You know, I've people who have gotten locked out of their account, or you know, had technical problems with, you know, a game running or purchasing something, all those sorts of things. And you know, unlike a lot of other, you know, businesses or people had come to expect with reaching out to customer service, we were not distributed, we were not in another country. It was like 30, 40 of us in the office in Bellevue, in a very small cluster of offices, in fact, handling every request that came through, and we did it all over email. So you had probably a million customers or more per customer service agent at that time.
How is that even possible to manage? A million customers per person?
Yeah. I mean, it's when I say a million, I mean, you know, not a million issues, right? But knowing that you have this many customers out there and that any one of them might reach out.
Right. Okay.
But the in terms of the how we did that, you know, is we did not do phone service or support. We did not do chat support. It was solely over email correspondence. And that meant that you could, you know, send many messages one after the other, and kind of handle the volume. That said, at that time, the reputation of Steam support was, well, you know, you're going to reach out to them and maybe you'll hear from them in a couple of weeks. Or, you know, it was not a great reputation, but it was something that was, you know, when I was brought on, was like, we need people to come here, we need to improve the process, and we need to, you know, be faster and have a better experience for customers.
So what was its IT infrastructure like when you got there? Was it bad? Was it okay?
Was it was. So after about 6 months in that position, so the company was in process to move offices and was looking around the company for people that could kind of participate in the transition. You know, that's kind of following in the general Valve philosophy of, you know, like, what do we have the resources for, even if there wasn't, you know, someone's sort of quote title or typical role, like, how could someone bring value in this case? And so I was, my name kind of bubbled up as someone who could help with some of the technical aspects. And at that point, very simplistically, hey, Chandler, can you make sure that, you know, all the folks in Steam support, that their, you know, their computer hardware kind of gets gathered, gets labeled, and is able to be moved over to the new location. And that was my first experience, you know, kind of working with the IT team in the company. And then once we had changed locations, then it was like, okay, well, you know, I was kind of given the opportunity to talk with that team more. And they saw, well, you know, here's someone who has this background, he might be valuable to this part of the company. And so they encouraged me to kind of sort of interview, as it were, with that part. And I did that, they liked me. And then 2 weeks after kind of moving into the IT group, they offered me a full-time position.
So what was one of the things that you did to improve the infrastructure, I guess you could say?
At first, they didn't trust me with infrastructure.
Work your way up.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you want to make sure that someone understands, what they're doing. Right. But, again, the kind of organization was the IT team was fewer than 10 people. And that was to manage all
that's
of the, that's very small. Especially for a company already at that size. This was, you know, in 2010. So it was originally, I was just, you know, helping with desktop support. So, helping the developers and other employees. And, but then again, my background had more experience in that. And, my first real kind of big opportunity to do something outside of, system administration or desktop support was to help expand the Steam content delivery network. And that's, something that Valve had done, and I would wager still continues to do better than their competition. When you buy a game, you have to download it to your system, right? And that's handled by a content delivery network. And it was at other businesses, without naming names, but some of the other places you can buy games and download them, not very fast, right? The experience was you whether you're buying a game or waiting for an update to a game, it would take a long time. And Valve did not want that to be the customer experience. We wanted it to be as fast as it could possibly be. And it wasn't at the time. So there's a sort of grand vision to expand that. And there were emerging sort of people like talk about cloud and other things, and there's definitely other networks that can do it, but Valve, like in many cases, wanted to be able to own it, wanted to have direct control over the system. And so it was essentially a private cloud that we built, and it went from about 200 gigabits per second worldwide when I started on that project to when I left the company, it was over 5 terabits. And wow. That was through sort of building, like scoping, ordering, configuring, deploying lots of server infrastructure to locations all around the world. And so I became very familiar with the needs of that system, and also became pretty familiar with a lot of international shipping and the obstacles and the secrets of getting things to move smoothly through the world. So so it was I wanted a customer to be able to get the game as fast as their home internet connection could handle. Especially with people having faster and faster speeds at home, I was like, I want your hard drive to be the bottleneck. Like, I want to max out your home internet connection, and as fast as we can write those bits to your hard disk, we will do that. And that's definitely, I think, what we achieved.
You make it sound easy, though. I'm sure it wasn't.
No, yeah. I mean, like I said, it was sending lots of server equipment, and big too, because the content library of the Steam catalog was, even at that time, probably a couple thousand different titles. And there's the games that are for sale currently on Steam, but then anything that had been previously and was maybe removed from sale, the customer still had a subscription to that, right? And they still needed to be able to download it. So the whole library is much larger than, what you'd see on the storefront, and that continues to be true. And then by the time I left, it was, 10,000, 14,000 different titles. And so you would hold that content, as much as you could, in a reasonable space on servers. So, terabits of games that were being refreshed, right? Because you'd hold so much, and then you take the oldest thing and cache it out, and then put in these new titles. And so it was constantly going through this cache of all of the available games that were on Steam at the time.
Right, but were you trying to expand the content delivery network to about 5 terabytes at the beginning, or was it more like, we have this goal that we just need to increase it over time? Was it small milestones as opposed to seeing the grand goal at the end?
Yeah, from my perspective, it wasn't, here is our target to hit, and we're gonna hit it by this time. And that's, I think, a big difference of Valve and other companies is like, okay, it's 2024. What are we going to, you know, what did we do last year? What are we going to do this year? What, how are we hitting those, you know, metrics? And very like process driven. It's like, okay, we've got this idea or we've got this problem, and how do we like apply resources to it, and what would we need, and what, you know, what does kind of success look like? But in some cases, success was like just, you know, where are customers? Well, they're in all of these different countries, all these different continents. What's the experience for like for them today, and how can we make it better? And so it was, there weren't specific milestones. It was just like, just where are the pain points? Like, where are, you know, the speeds slow, or where are there lots of cache misses? You know, they're trying to download games and they can't get them because we don't, the servers that we have there aren't big enough, or whatever the case may be.
But are you, does it feel like you're laying the tracks down directly in front of the train? Does it feel like that at
Oh,
times?
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. Which suited me, like, as I guess, and probably suits a lot of people at Valve in a number of ways. You know, and I mean, it's, you can do capacity planning for different infrastructure projects in a number of ways. So we were trying to like give us a bit more of track, you know. But you were kind of always chasing this moving target of, you know, meeting that need. And then it's also a bit of the, you know, painting the Golden Gate Bridge, right? Like, okay,
Yeah.
we've upgraded all of these servers and expanded this capacity across the globe, and now we're back where we started, and we need to go through and, you know, add another set of, you know, another cluster of servers and get these new connections fired up and grow this data center out and that sort of thing.
But was the IT team researching, say, for example, how many additional customers were joining Steam, but then also, I suppose, the internet infrastructure around the world, like there's Global Speed Index, right, which gives you an indicator of the average internet speeds around the world. Because obviously, as internet speeds increase and the customer base increases, you'd probably need to take that into account.
To a degree, you know, yeah. I mean, we would keep track of things like, you know, where was sort of major fiber being added around the world, major telecommunications lines being expanded. But you know, the overall customer base is largely split between North America and the US primarily, and Europe. And the other areas of the world were growing, but not quite the same because of whether it was internet infrastructure or PC usage, right? And I think that's, a big difference when you look at Valve and Steam's place in the entertainment world versus, you know, like the App Store or the Play Store on mobile, or Xbox Live and PSN on the console. It's like there are specific PC markets, at, you know, for whatever historical reasons. So we looked at like, okay, in our main customer hubs, you know, what are people seeing today and where are they? And those are, you know, follow population typically. And
Typically, yeah.
yeah, so it was, there weren't a lot of surprises. It was just like, make sure that we can, you know, keep up. As you say, there's the speed indexes, and but we can also see how many people are downloading from a server and what their, you know, average speeds are like, and that sort of thing. Like, we have our own internal data on it as well.
So, how did you end up organizing esports events?
So that was, well, it, you know, of course, the Dota 2 team kind of had spun up and, was looking to do the first international tournament, you know, which was in Cologne under Gamescom. And from the IT side, it was like, okay, what, this is mostly someone else's infrastructure, right? Like, this is a Gamescom event, and we're kind of just plugging into it. But we wanted to see like, okay, what do we need for this experience? And at the time, it was very reliant on third party for like the broadcasting of it. And so then it was like, okay, that was great. That felt like a success to us. We had a lot of, you know, excitement and, you know, the big prize and everything. And so now, again, how do we own this? How do we control it directly? And the plan kind of started of where we're going to host it. Well, we'll host it here in Seattle. So we're very close, it's in our backyard. And what are we going to need for that? Like, what kind of IT support are we going to need? And that's, again, where it was like, well, hey, the Dota team wants to do this. Like, IT team, what can we, you know, kind of contribute? And yeah, I sort of really got involved as, you know, someone who made sure that all of the, you know, the computers that we were using were built to a certain spec, that were, you know, met the needs of the players. And and then I just kind of, I was mastering that. And at the same time, it was like, you know, and we need basically referees to be, you know, involved to ensure that people aren't cheating and that sort of thing. But also because if something breaks, we can't, you know, stop for a couple hours and try and troubleshoot. It's like, what do we do? This is a live event. We got to stay up and running. So, you know, came up with different kind of plans for the fault tolerance. And then over years, as we continued to do the event and it got bigger and so on, it was, how do we keep doing this better and more? And so I was both a technical project manager, but also someone applying hands on and, you know, managing a team that was helping me do the event. And then also being a referee, I was involved with. And so I had no like prior experience with Dota 2 before then.
Really?
You know, or yeah, or the so, classic Dota. So
how did you know what was going on?
Through,
was it like a sink or swim sort of thing?
Yeah, it was like, okay, now, you know, just here's the idea and start learning, start playing, start, you know, getting into it. And that was the thing too, is like these players, these professionals who were generally many years younger than myself, were like, they were in this whole new world that I had to like acclimate to and understand and manage, because also, you know, they're not part of the company, they are professionals in their space. And, you know, how do you present a good image for the company to them without also like going crazy of, you know, these seem like unrealistic demands, or, you know, just unexpected, you know, things. We had to really be flexible and adaptable to what they needed.
Yeah. I mean, I used to do audio for events, and something I always found out is it doesn't matter how much you plan for something, some sort of curveball always comes up. Something goes wrong. Was that the experience for you?
Oh, for sure. I mean, yeah. we got pretty good at, you know, by the time I left Valve, you know, we had covered most of the bases. You know, we're still trying to push the envelope on things, but as far as how we handled those nuts and bolts of like the players on the stage, you know, and actually playing the game, we had that pretty dialed in. And audio was a big challenge at the start too. It's interesting that you mentioned that, because you know, for a lot of the players, they either hadn't played LANs, they had been all playing remotely, or they had very specific setups that weren't really like designed for being on a stage, you know, in front of a live audience, because then you're also trying to like prevent them from cheating. Like, how do you have commentary on an event that's live when there's, you know, secret information between the teams, you know, without them hearing it? And then it's like, well, some teams, you know, we don't use headsets, we don't use microphones, we just talk to each other, shout to each other. Others are like, we have to have our headsets and they have to work in this specific way, and there can't be any lag, and there can't, you know, there's got to be the right you know, adjustments. And so we had to kind of satisfy all of those. And we really did have few major issues. A lot of stuff we kind of foresaw of like, oh, if a computer has this problem or this, you know, gear has this problem, then we're going to do this. There were only a couple curveballs. I think it was TI3. I don't think it was the first event that, you know, we had some kind of DDoS activity leveled at us. And that took us offline. But we at least had a plan, right? Like we had things in place and we were able to work around it.
Well, you're trying to mitigate the risk as much as possible, right?
Exactly.
So you're trying to conceive of every possible thing that can go wrong and to prevent it.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And in Valve's case, it's like we've got the resources, like we have the sort of budget for it, because overall the cost of the event is like not that big when you compare it with major corporations' advertising budgets, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, for sure.
It's actually a pretty meaning. It's a meaningful amount, but it's very manageable. So it was like, okay, we've got money. Like, how do you know what do we do? Like, how can we apply this and solve these problems or you know head them off? And you know, what do we have the time for? What do we have the bandwidth for? And the yeah, so it. It was, you know, you were prepared. We had backups upon backups, you know, fail safes and sort of that sort of stuff. But and then you just understood like, okay, it's a live event. Things will happen, and how do we, you know, respond to them? And then, you know.
But do you test things with the competitors before you go live? So obviously you do like a setup with the competitors, or do you get someone else to test it first? Because obviously, as you mentioned, everyone has their own setups and they all have their own way of doing things. So do you test it with them first?
Yeah. So what we established was before competition began, we would boot camp and we would have each team come in, sit down at their computers in their order, right? Because they have a like 1 through 5 left to right sequence that they require, and just get their gear. And that's the thing too, is it's much different than other sort of, you know, traditional sports of like, well, yeah, okay, you've got the specifics set of shoes or glove or whatever, but they're all within a certain regulation and you get them from a factory type thing. Like we're like, yes, these things, these keyboards and mice, they're coming from factories, but everyone has a different preference. Some of them are using gear that's been you know, from a sponsor or whatever, and it's all over the place, and they insist that it's the same. Like they bring their gear wherever they go. And it's like, well, how do you do that when you have so many teams that you have to go through? And, you know, you also want to be, you know, making sure that someone isn't doing something nefarious with the hardware that they're bringing to the table because of the electronics involved. And, but, we would go through the boot camp for every team and try to get things kind of set and dialed in as much as possible. As things progressed and we were introducing like full sort of, like mixing panels for their audio, it was like, even okay, some of these teams, we have to make these minor adjustments. You know, these audio equalizer settings will work for 90% of the teams, and then this last 10% we'll have to kind of tweak. But it took a lot of prep just at the beginning, and then it's like, as you're doing the format of the event, by having like a group stage first allowed you to then kind of work out other issues before you went to a major venue and did a fully live performance.
So how much of a gamer were you before all this stuff?
I've been a gamer since I was, you know, 5 years old.
were you a PC gamer or a console gamer?
No, I was always a console gamer. My family didn't have a home computer until I was like middle school, high school, so kind of relatively late for compared with my peers. But I took to it right away and, you know, really got into computers and gaming, and that's how I sort of ended up in the IT field, was that exposure. But I wasn't a Steam customer really at all until Left 4 Dead came out, and I was like, oh, that game sounds kind of cool. And I hadn't even played, like, I knew of Half-Life, but I hadn't gotten into it, or Counter-Strike or anything like that. But I thought, like, oh, Left 4 Dead, that sounds like a really interesting concept. And I was fresh from college, and I didn't have money, because I'm paying off my student loans and trying to make a living and
Story of
all that.
everyone's life, yeah.
And I will admit that I tried to acquire different game titles from places that were less than above board, and Steam taught me not to do that. It taught me that if you want to play this game, you should buy a copy of it, because then it will work properly. It'll work in the right language. And it's a good experience, and the experience is getting better. So I say that, like, Steam was the thing that showed me the sort of light of, here's how computer gaming should be. And then, of course, once you start at the company, you've got the full master subscription of all the games that you want,
Yeah, of course.
and then it ruined me forever. Because then it was like, suddenly my bar went, like, up to here. It's like, I have too many games I can try. If a game isn't good within the first 5 to 10 minutes, then I'm gonna uninstall and put on another one. Just be totally spoiled.
So, do you have a favorite Valve game and a favorite game per se, or are they both one and the same?
I would say that, I definitely put a lot of hours into Dota 2 in the end, more so than all the other titles.
Probably a good thing if you're organizing esports events for a
Exactly.
day.
Yeah. And yeah, because you want, like, there's the whole evolving meta and new characters and abilities and all that kind of stuff. Like, so staying on top of it, I have not for years now, actually. So I don't know what's going on with Dota 2. I think that overall, like, I am the I'm most proud to say that I was a part of Portal 2.
I was going to
It
ask
was
you
my
about Portal 2 because,
it was the first credit that I had
well, yeah,
when I started at Valve.
but the thing is with the credits and how it works is it doesn't state what your actual part in the game is, right? It's just got a list of all the credits. So even though you're listed on Portal 2, I have no idea what you did in Portal 2, and I think most people don't either. So what did you actually do in Portal 2?
What did you do? Well, the philosophy there, I don't know if the others have covered this, but it's like everyone at the company contributes to the
Yes.
success of a game in some way,
I agreed.
because it's like, as an IT person, I'm making sure that the developers have working computers, right? I'm making sure that, we have whatever tools or systems are needed to kind of render or record sound or whatever. Like, the whole process is dependent on technology. So all of IT is contributing to that goal of a successful game, in one way or another. That said, I did contribute beyond that, as did many other people, in the playtesting. And because Valve then, and I would assume still to today, does not hire or outsource their QA.
Don't they get DigiPen to help out though? Is it DigiPen?
So DigiPen was the source of, the kind of original concept
Yeah,
creators,
that's
right,
right.
for both Portal and Portal 2. We would bring in people from outside in order to just kind of, like, try it out. But in terms of, like, hey,
Actual playtesting, yeah.
actual playtesting, like, levels, or chapters like 1 through 12 are live right now on our beta Steam platform. Like, if your last name is this, like, go play this level or whatever, you know.
Is that how they do it? Okay.
But you know, it wasn't compulsory. It was we need to have coverage, and these are the things we're looking for. And of course, as a gamer, you know, I would jump at the chance to try it out. And actually, funny story is that, you know, when you go and look at Left 4 Dead 2, well, not even Left 4 Dead, but like across both of those games, there's all the graffiti that's inside of the world. And most of it is, or much of it is, like scanned writing. And so I won't forget that before it was in the old building, I was still a contractor, but it was like, hey, we need people to write stuff down. Like, we just need your handwriting, as it were. We'll tell you what to write. Just come to this one office and, you know, we'll give you something to write down. And so I went and did that. And it was for, I think, the first Left 4 Dead 2's DLC, which is escaping me now, but I wrote, do you think they poop? Was my sentence to write. And so I wrote, do you think they poop, in my own handwriting, and then they took it and they scanned it, and then eventually it's, you know, it's in the game written on the inside of a bathroom stall of do you think they poop, and then
hilarious.
Someone else had written, I saw one poop a foot, and then I was like, this is my first claim to video game fame, is writing, do you think they poop, and having it put up on the screen. So yeah, I mean, and that was the thing, is like, we just need people to do this, and who can find some time to contribute. And that's a great way to, like, just one, keep people involved in the process of what, you know, how the games are made and all that, but also just, it's a fun diversion. And by letting people have the agency to choose to do that in their day, helps employees feel really, like, empowered and, you know, satisfied. And, you know, that's kind of, we haven't really talked about, like, the magic or the mystery of Valve, but I think those are some good examples of how you can do that.
So was there one particular thing you found or a bug when you were playtesting Portal 2?
Oh, geez.
Or was it just so good you were like, oh, this is amazing?
Yeah. No, there's definitely, I mean, across Portal 2, Left 4 Dead 2, TF2, all those two, Soda 2.
There's no threes yet.
No, CSGO. You know, there are plenty of bugs that I reported, whether or not I was a unique reporter of them. Who knows or remembers. But there were, you know, again, we had the tools to just, something would happen and you'd say, this is what I was doing. And I don't recall anything from any of the particular games, but all typical stuff.
Well, that's probably
a
good thing. Yeah. It's probably run-of-the-mill stuff then, I'm guessing.
Exactly. Yeah. A lot of, like, oh, this string was missing, you know, or so it's showing developer text instead of, you know, friendly player text, or, you know, this texture is not there. It's a black and white checkerboard where a texture should be, or, you know, in some of those cases, like, oh, I, you know, the nav mesh is broken, and so I fell through the floor of the game and was trapped,
right,
you know, beneath the world, that kind of stuff.
Is it along the last stretch of the game where you start playtesting, or is it all throughout? Because if it is the latter, then it would be cool, I would imagine, seeing the transition as it enters.
Oh, no, there's I mean, each title had to sort of reach a certain point in its development amongst the core team before other people from other teams would be asked to, like, I mean, people would be asked to look at it and try things, but in terms of, we want to have broad coverage of this, it needed to be at, you know, some sufficient alpha state that you could have people come in, or even get into the beta. But yeah, Portal 2 is one that, like, when I first started it, they had not I don't know if they hadn't signed or if they just hadn't recorded the Wheatley dialogue from Stephen Merchant. And so it was actually a Valve employee was doing all of that dialogue that they had written. And I thought he did a great job. I wouldn't say I was disappointed with Stephen Merchant, but it was like,
Who was the person that originally voiced it? Do you remember?
It was Richard. Yeah, it was Richard Lord.
Okay.
Also British, and it was great. He did a great read for the Wheatley character. But yeah, it was, and then the levels, you know, how they looked, and you know, the feel definitely still had changes over that time from the final product. So yeah, it was really interesting to be a part of that process from not beginning to end, but you know, very early to end.
Mm. Did it make you want to become an actual developer? Or were you like, no, I'm quite content being the IT guy?
I definitely over the years, you know, tried to pick up more you know, programming knowledge. But I always just bounced off of it. I could never really stick with something or feel that kind of inspiration or passion kindle or ignite. So it's like, yeah, no, it's too late for me. But then I, you know, as I kind of later into my career, I did kind of move away from doing IT stuff. So I did pursue new things, but not game development.
Did you have any interaction with Gabe, or was he like a person with a bit of a force field around him that it's just you can't really get to?
Yeah, I had a few interactions here and there. I mean, definitely when you started, especially if you hadn't been in the industry, you know, or were courted by the company to, you know, join, it's a bit of intimidation factor, you know, because he is you know, a renowned person in the industry, and you know, very successful. It's like, hey, this man's a billionaire, you know, like he's just walking around in his sandals, you know, through the office. And he also just has kind of this projects this you know, this,
like
this
a presence.
Seriousness, this presence, exactly. Yeah. I mean, he has a sort of seriousness to him, but then he's also, you know, he likes to joke with people a lot, and he, you know, doesn't always take things too seriously. But yeah, I think the first time that I had like the courage to go up to him and ask him a question about something, it was just like, hey, what do you think about the needs of the support team, and you know, where we're headed and what we're doing? And he gave his thoughts, but it was like that was how he was. You could ask him a question, he would give you his honest opinion about it, whether or not it was like at the forefront of his mind. But he answered it. He wasn't like, I don't know, I don't have time to deal with you, I don't know, you know who you are. He was very respectful of the people that worked at the company, because he knew that everyone else was making the company successful, right? Like, he had driven it and bankrolled it and got the thing started. But once it reached, you know, a certain point, especially by the time I had joined the company, it was like, this company is successful because the people who work here and, you know, what we're trying to do, he's there to still be Gabe, you know, and be a part of it. But that it really hung on the shoulders of everyone who worked there.
Yeah, I think there's some concern that if he hangs up the gloves, so to speak, what will happen to the company? Because a lot of people feel that sort of stuff comes from the top down, and it echoes through the team. So there is, he's irreplaceable, really. I mean, who could do what he does? Yes. It takes a special individual.
Yeah. Yeah, and he definitely is, like, again, when you kind of consider the industry as a whole, it is a unique figure, and has persisted for many years, you know, at the same company doing this, you know, doing what he loves. But I think that, again, the company has reached a point where he's not involved in the direct day to day.
No,
just like
he's not.
Most CEOs and founders aren't. But he also, even more so than other CEOs, he's not there to be like, I'm the captain of this ship, and I am answering to, this board of directors or these shareholders, and I need to like do it to keep my job. It's like this company is what it is now. It's its own beast. And kind of like the ship of Theseus, if you've replaced all of the different parts of it, is it the same ship? And it's like, and that's not to say things haven't like changed, improved or worsened in certain, I don't know, but like, overall they've hit upon, a lot of success and, successful ways of working. So if he's, if he just step back, it's like, well, the company's going to keep doing what it's doing. And I think for most customers, it doesn't matter. There's a lot of vocal customers in the Steam player base, that analyze everything and are very, they post about stuff online or whatever, but like they make up the tiny
a vocal minority,
very loud
minority.
But it's like people are like, I'm gonna, if they do this, I'm gonna quit, or I'm gonna demand a refund or whatever. Like their threats are, most people are like, oh, this is great. I bought a game and I downloaded it and I played it and it worked and I'm happy. End of story. So,
well, I think the good thing about Steam is it's managed to avoid the problem that plagues the film industry, right? Because it's got like a monopoly on PC gaming, but it hasn't allowed itself to be fragmented. Like, because how there's all these film streaming platforms, like you got Netflix and Hulu and Disney Plus, and as a result, people get frustrated because they just want to get their films in one place, right? But you have to end up subscribing to all these different platforms, whereas Steam is its own beast. It gets pretty much nearly every game for the most part.
Yes, and that is the thing. It's like, for the most part, right? And content is, can be the king. There are competitors to Steam, right? I mean, you have, whether in sort of a direct fashion of like, EA's Origin and Ubisoft, these companies have tried to do it. They just don't quite do what Valve has done. Epic has done really well with the Epic Game Store. But even that is not,
it's not anywhere on the same level.
It's very, it's hugely successful, right, in its own way, but it's not doing it. And so things are a little bit fractured in that regard of like, where are the community of players, right? Like, if I buy this game that is on both platforms, where are my friends buying it? Because, it's a multiplayer game. So that's one of the biggest influences, right? Is if a company buys into an exclusivity deal, then you kind of force players to shunt one way or the other. But at this point, so many have, if they're playing on PC, have a Steam account, right? And that's kind of, and the community features are what give Steam, or one of the things that give them the advantage, right? Is like, they made it so that people wanted to play there with other people and, see things from other people, and that makes it sticky. The community aspects are basically missing in every other platform. So then it's like, well, it's just a place to buy something, right? It's not a place I want to live. It's just, it's a transactional. It is a little different from, it doesn't feel as fractured, but at the same time, it is, but it isn't.
But there is this view online that because Steam became so big, Valve doesn't make many games anymore. But I mean, do you feel that that's true or not?
I would say that across the history, it hasn't been true. Like when you the release, you know, when you look at the release dates, it's like games kept coming out, at Steam kept growing, but you know, things were being worked on. And the other thing too that I think that is often lost with that idea is, you know, look at what TF2 started as to what it became, right? Like it didn't become TF3, but it is a vastly different game in how you play it, and that it, you know, is part of the idea of, you know, it's iterative, it is games as a service before anyone threw that out there.
Well, it's like Counter-Strike, how there's like Counter-Strike, yes, Go 2, which is, you know, it's just an expansion, not the first one. Iterative, yes, so to speak.
Yes. Yeah. And that too goes back to like the splintering, right? Like every new Call of Duty, you know, like sure, you could release them every year, every other year. You're not playing with the people that you were before, right? Like everyone has to buy to be enjoying the new experience, whereas TF2 you can pick up now, you know, or 10 years ago, right? And it's the same player base, can be tapped into along with the new. So, but you know, I think it does seem, since I've left the company, so maybe that's the correlation, is without me, they stopped making new games.
Maybe you can claim that.
Yeah. There's been Alex.
I've just been wanting a Portal 3, and I think a lot of people do. Eric Walpole says he wants to make one, and you clearly love Portal 2, so.
Oh yeah, I mean it's tough. Like you certainly can, if you have such a big moneymaker as Steam and the games like CS:GO and Dota 2, like these games that can contribute revenue to the company, you can get a little comfortable in experimentation of things. And that's because that's the thing, is people don't know about all the games that have been worked on but just never reached a point where
you know
they could move forward. You know, so you, when you don't see that, you're like, oh, well, they don't make new games. It's like, well, because they don't have games that reach the bar, right? When you have some of the best, you know, critically acclaimed titles, you're not just going to fire them off, you know, willy-nilly.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's right. Do you know how much the servers cost to run per month when you were there? Were they very costly? Because I think people just think that Valve just sits on Scrooge McDuck money and is just swimming in cash, you know. But obviously, I'm sure there's a lot of the overheads, and the cost of running servers will only go up, I would say.
Yeah, so actually, the expenditures for the infrastructure, not very high as a part of the whole sort of bottom line. Like as a percentage, pretty low, because we were doing things directly. And in a very lean way, right? Like when you start hiring, because like you said, an IT team of 10 people, that might be one section of one group in another business, right? You might have hundreds of people for a company making the same revenue as Valve. So we did a lot with a little for the infrastructure, and that kept our costs low. But for that, we also, you know, paid employees well, gave a lot of, you know, cushy perks and benefits to working in the company. And, you know, I mean, it's probably, there probably still is a vault of gold coins, you know, somewhere that I didn't get to see, but it's also like, there's only so much, you can only throw so much money at something to improve it or to change it.
Yeah, well, throwing money at a problem doesn't necessarily fix the problem.
Yeah. And as it is, it's like, what's the other complaint? Well, if I'm going to pass the savings on, you know, give me the customer a better deal. And it's like, well, if the game's already 75% off, like what, you know, what more can we do to to share in the wealth here.
Well, what's that saying? Give an inch, take a mile. I mean, yes. It doesn't matter what you do. You know, yes. Someone's always going to complain anyway. So I guess Absolutely. It's trying to work out where you place your time and resources.
Right. Well, and I mean, just the fact that, you know, you were paying for an Xbox Live subscription, a gold subscription, to be able to play multiplayer games, right? Not necessary with Steam. You know, the software is free, the you know, all of those additional features that were added over the years, and the community and broadcasting and, you know, just everything, all free to the customer. So it's like we're really trying to put a lot back into the platform to make the customer experience better, the player experience better, and not asking for anything in return, right?
Yeah. Final question before I let you go. I know we're going a little bit over time, but I just wanted to quickly ask about your time working in AI dentistry, right? Because the dental industry is something you don't hear a lot about. It's extremely costly. So is this sort of stuff going to help reduce cost, or is it just making the technology better to get better dental work?
Yeah. So, kind of first, I didn't go from Valve to
no. I know you didn't go straight.
There's some bits in the middle, but that's where it's kind of important, because I started my own company in between, in consumer technology, and the idea is that we put a hands-free Alexa device onto the back of the phone, so people could use Alexa outside their homes the same way that they do in the homes. That's the high level. People will be like, "Why can't I just use Siri, or can I do that?" There's lots of questions. This is also why the company wasn't long-term successful, despite making a product. I did make a product and ship it to Kickstarter backers.
But I'm sure you learned a lot from it. So it wasn't...
And I learned an amazing amount from it. Hugely
So it wasn't a failure. If you learn something, then something is never a failure.
Right. Yes. But that got me into understanding, you know, AI from the voice perspective, and then seeing how people are developing products, you know, in other industries. And for dentistry, in my life of, you know, having, I guess, dental insurance coverage from my parents, and, you know, had it instilled of like, you go to the dentist, you have your cleanings and examinations, and if there's a problem, they make a suggestion, and then you should do it because you like your teeth and you don't like pain or whatever, and that's that. And when I started at Video Health, I learned that only 25% of treatment plans that are presented, like, hey, you've got a sort of a cavity developing, we need to fill, only 25% of those are accepted by patients for different reasons of, well, like, oh, it doesn't bother me, so I don't want to do it, the cost, the time, whatever the case may be. And so what you see is, like, there's a lot of unresolved health issues, and we have now since found that there's also, like, these connections between your dental, your oral health, and your overall health in your body.
Yep.
And so the vision of the company was, like, how can we improve patient outcomes, you know, for everyone, with the application of artificial intelligence. And in this case, it was looking at radiographic images, x-rays, is something that dentists are trained to do, but there's so many minor variations, right? You're looking at so many images and the way they're taking people's different, you know, mouth structures. You might miss things, you might not, you might get everything correctly, but then you also have to convey that information to the patient. So there's a lot of areas where there are potential improvements. And what they've done is analyzed thousands and thousands of x-rays with the assistance of real practitioners who, you know, from, you know, fresh out of dentistry school to 25 years, you know, in patient care, and had them identify the things that they saw and then use that to train the model, which was then submitted to the FDA and was certified as a medical device and could provide, valid diagnosis. And that is what that means practically, is that when you sit down and the dentist shows you your x-ray, they can say, and here are the, the areas, and this has been confirmed, by AI, by this algorithm. You've got the computer as your instant second opinion. And that drastically increases the acceptance of treatment plans, right? Because there's a lot of suspicion, right? Of like, is this really a problem? Again, like, I don't feel pain.
Well,
you're just trying to get money out of me.
I think this is the case in all Western countries, but dental work tends to be quite costly. I mean, my wife's from India, and I just pretty much wait to go to India every year or two to get dental work done because it's so much cheaper. But I'd imagine costs would be a big thing for a lot of people, particularly if it's something major. Well, you've got all these things that you've got to fix.
Right. Well, and that's the other issue too, is that people have, they've had the suspicion early, and then the problem just gets worse, right? Because you don't have something treated early on, it advances, it progresses, and now it is a much more expensive problem than it was before, right?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Now it is a root canal, whereas before we could have, early on we could have put a sealant on it and kept your tooth intact. And so again, people see that like it's very costly, but it also, you have to show them like there's a level of trust that's needed.
Yeah.
Right.
But is this technology been, is it around the world now? Has it been sent, has this been passed on to other dental practitioners around the world, or is it more an American thing? Like if somebody flew to Thailand, would they have access to this stuff, for example?
Yeah, presently this is a very much within the US where,
right. Okay.
Where we're seeing the growth, as well as Canada. And of course the plans for all of the companies in the space is to grow beyond that, but it's started here. But the results have been amazing. Like I said, there's a huge increase in the treatment plan acceptance and the identification of issues. And it's just good for both sides, right? Because the patient gets something that they can trust and understand. And their provider is able to make more money and also be more efficient with their time. They get to see, they can very quickly have that conversation with the patient to be on to their next one. It works well for the insurance process because now you've got this additional standard that can be applied to say, we're looking to have this treatment paid for by insurance, and here's what the AI says, so it allows them to accept and process those faster. So it's kind of a win-win.
It's probably still in its infancy as well, right? Because obviously we're still in the early days of
AI revolution,
so to speak.
Exactly. So, it's definitely a race right now between the companies in this space to get their names out and get people to understand. I mean, it was 2 years ago, people were saying, why would I need AI in my dental practice? Last year, the conversation became, well, what makes your eye better or different than the competition? So patients will start to hear about it, understand it, and demand it. And I think that'll spread across the US, and it's going to be the same for other places in the world too.
Well, hey, I will wrap up there. I could talk to you for hours. You're a very interesting fellow with a lot of knowledge, a lot of wisdom. But if anyone wants to keep up to date with what you're doing, is there any place they can do that? Or are you largely off social media?
I would say I'm largely off public social media with the exception of LinkedIn. You can find me on LinkedIn as a professional. That's about the extent of it.
Cool.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Thanks for chatting. This has been fascinating.
Yeah.
It's been very fascinating.
If you ever want to have a follow-up, ask more questions.
We might have to. Not enough time. So that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.